This is Radio Boston. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Adam Ragusea, in for Anthony Brooks.
Stop the violence! Stop the violence! Stop
that was the rallying cry last month at Bridgewater State University's Take Back the Night event.
For more than a decade, similar rallies have taken place on college campuses nationwide. Take Back the Night events have a simple goal: raise awareness of and bring an end to sexual assault. A goal rather eloquently stated in its motto, "Shatter the silence, stop the violence."
The Bridgewater rally drew about 200 people, and among the crowd were members of the school's media, including a reporter for the student-run newspaper, The Comment, as well as a university videographer who captured this.
The student you just heard chose to break the silence in her own way. Megaphone in hand, she told the campus crowd her story about how she'd been attacked and raped by an ex-boyfriend in a dormitory basement. She also gave her own name.
Later that week, both her name and her story appeared in The Comment, the Bridgewater State student newspaper. Outrage swiftly flooded The Comment's website.
There is a huge difference between volunteering to speak at an outdoor assembly and having your entire story posted online for anyone to see, wrote one student.
Another one said, "Such blatant disregard for a person's well-being and safety is disgusting to me. Do you not understand your article is putting a person in danger?"
The Comment staff acknowledged the long-held tradition in journalism of not publishing rape victims' names without consent. But in a follow-up editorial, the paper threw in a very 21st century twist, saying that when someone speaks in a public forum, consent is implied, and any information the student did not share at the rally was, quote, easily found by looking at her publicly accessible social media profiles.
This isn't an invasion of privacy, the paper concluded. It's simple fact-checking and good journalism.
Well, is it? Here we have a case of the perfect journalistic storm when social media, journalistic mores around sexual assault and campus rallies are all blurring and warping old assumptions about what's public and what's private. Well, joining us now to talk a little bit more about this is Helen Benedict, journalism professor at Columbia University and author of several books, including Virgin or Vamp, How the Press Covers Sex Crimes. Helen Benedict, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you.
Also with us is Kelly McBride, who teaches and writes about journalism and journalism ethics for the Poynter Institute, and who has frequently written about sexual assault in the media. Kelly McBride, welcome to you, too.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
It's great to have both of you. And we should just say right now that WBUR up front has made a decision to not name the student, because as local media critic Dan Kennedy has so well put it, we're here to talk about the controversy and not necessarily become a part of it. So, Helen Benedict, let me just start with you. Do you feel that the student newspaper violated the privacy of the young woman who spoke out at that Take Back the Night rally?
I think that their answer is neither yes nor no. It's somewhere in between, because we have to parse out the different tacks they took. I'm very uneasy with them snooping through her Facebook profile and social media and saying that was public property. I think that's a different thing. The rule ought to be that when somebody speaks out in public and a journalist is going to cover it, the journalist ought to approach, I think, and this is part of what we teach at the journalism school, should approach the speaker and identify herself as a journalist and say, "May I quote you?" or "I'm here to cover it." Somehow inform the speaker. Of course, it's different if it's a politician who is hoping to reach journalists. But when a private citizen speaks out, it's the polite and considerate and sensitive thing to do, especially under circumstances like this.
Well, there are several parts of this story here which you've accurately identified. One is that the student spoke in public at that Take Back the Night rally first. Second is the social media part. We'll get to that part in just a moment. But Kelly McBride, let me just first of all get your initial thought on, do you agree that if a person is speaking who's not a politician at a public event, that does not actually equate to consenting to have their name published?
No, I don't. And, you know, let me first start by saying part of the work that I've done here at the Poynter Institute is to examine why the media is so bad about covering sexual assault. Because for the most part, we in the media do a pretty bad job of covering sexual assault. But that said, and some of it is because there are so many inhibitions around the victim, because there is real stigma associated with being raped. But at a public event, in general, when someone is speaking at a public event, it is a public pronouncement. It is a soapbox. It is the town square. And so it's not a normal practice in journalism for public events in general to go and check with the speaker to make sure it's okay to mention their participation.
But you don't think it should be that there actually should be a different set of rules for people who are speaking out even about sexual assault for exactly the reason that you said, because of the stigma, because of the fear that once it's in the media, that instant spread of that information could, as some students were worrying, put the person in danger?
Well, I think that there's culpability here on the part of many people. So within the community of victim advocates, there is a fair amount of controversy over whether the names of sexual assault victims should be kept confidential. And most believe that they should, but some believe that it only enhances that stigma by doing so. And so I think that organizers of such an event have an obligation to let people know if the ground rules are different for this event than any other public event. The organizers have an obligation to let people know. They also have an obligation to coach the speakers that this is a public event. There could be video cameras. People could be using their cell phones and posting stuff to YouTube. And if you don't want your name used, you know, you wouldn't print it in any sort of directory or bulletin for the event or flyer. And you know, you could talk to the reporters about, you know, she's speaking here, but she doesn't want to be named. And I think that probably reporters would be happy to oblige that request. In this case, I don't know how the reporter was supposed to know that this particular individual did not want to be named, since she herself gave her name to the crowd.
Well, let me turn back to Helen Benedict on that point. Professor Benedict, it seems to me that in this day and age, when you are in a public forum, you're out in a public space. And I mean, for an event like Take Back the Night, whose motto includes shattering the silence, I mean, as Kelly McBride was saying, do you not have to assume that somehow your story is going to get out into the media in some way, shape, or form? I mean, everyone seems to be holding up a cell phone, taking a picture. Maybe we should just not presume privacy any longer unless we explicitly ask for it while standing at the podium.
Well, it's because of that ambiguity that I made the suggestion I made. The journalist is is within her rights to quote somebody who's speaking publicly. I'm not talking about the rules. I'm talking about reporting sensitively, because reporting sensitively is what's lacking in a lot of the way we cover sexual assault, as Kelly McBride said. It's what my book is about how badly we do this. Therefore, under the circumstances, I think a lot of trouble would have been avoided had the reporter gone a bit further than the rules demand and thought to be sensitive enough to go up to this person and see if she did realize how public she was being. Not everybody is sophisticated enough, you know, to really understand the implications of how far their speech might go in public. Maybe
is that
she
not,
felt that it was because it was campus, that it was somehow more private. Maybe she didn't. But why not check?
Mm-hmm. Well, in fact, I think some people were online at the comment that's the student newspaper on their website were making exactly this point, that they felt that campus is their community, that it's not necessarily a public space, or the students don't think of it that way. But on the other hand, is there not a sense of, you know, the journalistic community, the media being somewhat patronizing and checking with people, saying, do you know what you're doing? Is this okay? Are you truly okay with that?
I don't see that being considerate as patronizing, no. I mean, of course, it depends how the person puts it, but I wouldn't worry about that. I mean, the person who is always missing, who in these cases and how we cover sexual assault as the victim and what is good for her or him and what he or she needs. And the more sensitive we are and the more respectful of their needs, the better job we will do. So it's not about being condescending. That's not the worry. It's not my worry.
Listeners, we are talking about naming rape victims in modern day media, and specifically a case at Bridgewater State University where the student newspaper put the name of a rape survivor in the newspaper after she had spoken at a public campus Take Back the Night event. So do you think the student newspaper violated that victim's privacy by publishing her name, or do you give up your right to privacy or expectations of privacy when you speak at a public event? And more broadly, we wonder, does the media's decision not to print a victim's name without consent, does that change the nature of the coverage of sexual assault stories itself? Is the original intent of preserving a person's privacy, preserving their safety, maybe leading to stories that aren't the best for talking frankly about sexual assault in America? Give us a call at 1-800-423-8255. That's 800-423-TALK. Matthew writes on our website, radioboston.org, that he's a student at Bridgewater State, and he actually shares the outrage on campus that the comment, that student newspaper, let this happen. He says, this is not like regular journalistic covering other controversial subjects. It wasn't a journalistic decision to publish the victim's name. It was a mistake. Kelly McBride, let's take a step back and remind us, what was the original thinking that led to this journalistic tradition of not publishing the names of sexual assault victims?
So in the late 1970s and 1980s, as the feminist movement gained traction, different rape crisis agencies developed in local communities around the country, and many of them approached their local newsrooms, newspapers and television stations, and pointed out that if you publish the names of rape victims, they are less likely to come forward and report the crime. And already it is the most underreported felony by vast amounts compared to any other felony crime. And so most newspapers and television stations and now online news sites willingly instituted these policies with great conformity. So it is really rare to actually see the name of a rape victim in a news story. Mm. And the exceptions are when she or he publicly identify themselves, and in most cases this means willingly participate in the story. But the other exception that a lot of newsrooms have argued about is when a victim sues her or his attacker in civil court, because in many states they are required to put their name on the lawsuit. They can't file as a Jane Doe or a John Doe. And so that's the other time that we argue this point a lot. But increasingly what's happened is the stories that we tell in newspapers and on television about rape victims don't actually capture the truth of the matter. And one of the reasons that they don't capture the truth of the matter is because there's always a voice missing, and it's the voice of the victim. And so journalists are increasingly looking for victims who are willing to put their name to their stories as a way to correct that missing piece, because in fact we're misinforming the public by the types of stories we tell.
Helen Benedict, your response to that, and I guess I'm also curious as to what your thoughts is, has this tradition of not naming victims, has it actually led to any positive effect in terms of willingness to come forward, willingness to prosecute crimes or to bring charges against attackers, things like that?
Well, I do mostly agree with what was just said, but I think that the real approach we need to take to informing the public better does not rest on whether you name the victim or not, because a mere name, unless the victim is famous, doesn't mean anything to people. It does rest in describing you know, the real effects, the horror of the crime itself, the ways in which it's violent, the ways in which it's harmful, the kind of damage it does. When I studied close up the kinds of cases that I put in my book, I noticed that most of them glossed over how violent a crime rape really is and how damaging it is to the victim and to those who love her and how it can go on for years and years and years. We're missing all that and how prevalent it is. We never cover what causes it. We never cover why we have so much violent sexual violence against women in this country. Where is it coming from? Who are the rapists? Why do men rape? These are the sorts of stories we don't do enough that would really help enlighten the public. And I think putting women in danger and further exposing their privacy to the public isn't necessarily going to help. I've spoken to quite a few victims who did willingly allow themselves to be named when their cases were covered, who then came to regret it because they would go to buy something, show a credit card, somebody would recognize their names because of the press coverage and look them up and down, and visually you strip them with their eyes and the person could see their, you know, this other person imagining them being raped, which was felt like being raped all over again.
Well, Helen Benedict, I'd like to just ask you about that because, you know, for example, Nick Kristof in the New York Times, he's written previously, this is a quote from him, that it's impossible to get rape on the agenda when the victims are anonymous, that human beings just aren't hardwired to feel compassion for classes of victims, but they are for individuals. So we can't necessarily control what another person is thinking when a story is out there. May I take your point that that's a risk that rape victims take? But what do you make of this idea that for as long as names aren't attached to these stories, it just isn't going to have the resonance or become part of the conversation in the way that it could, that maybe rape as a violent crime should be?
I really like Kristof's work, but I don't agree. The name alone is not the thing that makes the rape feel real to the reader. It's the way it's written about. And if journalists need the name to make it feel real, then they're not doing a good job understanding the crime itself.
Let's take a quick call here.
It does make a difference to how many people report, to answer your second question.
And I'm sorry that I interrupted you there, but I'm seeing that we've got several callers who want to join us, so let's hear from one of them. Mark is calling from Boxford. You're on the air, Mark.
Good afternoon. The thing that struck me about the Bridgewater State uproar is, while I agree that any victim of a sexual crime, their identity should be protected, once an individual goes public, whether it's about a sexual assault or anything else for that matter, and tells their story, gives their name, does it in a public forum, they've made a conscious decision to forego their privacy.
Mark, thank you so much for your call. Let me turn that back to our guests, Helen Benedict and Kelly McBride. And Kelly, let me start with you, because Mark also sort of opens the door to the second half of this very interesting story, which is that the student newspaper at Bridgewater State University said that it also looked at the young woman's publicly available social media profiles, and they emphasize it was the publicly available part of it. So, I mean, when we have so many different platforms by which information is made public by choice, by an individual's choice, I mean, did the student newspaper go too far in using social media?
Well, I'm not sure that they went too far. I think they should have gone one further step. If they're on her Facebook profile, then they can easily direct message her on Facebook to make sure that this is who they think it is, to make sure that they're interpreting the information correctly. And so I don't have any problem with using publicly available information, whether it's a Facebook page or some other sort of social media. But I do think that it's really important for accuracy's sake in journalism that you not just take what's there on the Facebook page, but that you do some more reporting. And that then would have given the source the opportunity to say, Oh, you know, you're getting this wrong, or I didn't realize you were going to use my name, could you not, or something like that. It would have given her the opportunity to interact with the reporter. And so the reporter should have done that. I don't think she should be fired. I don't think the paper should be shut down or anything because they didn't take that extra step. I just think that they should they should know that there's an extra step to using social media as a tool.
Well, the student editor-in-chief of the paper says that the university, she says the university basically said that they would do not support the paper and didn't support its actions. But Helen Benedict, your thoughts, I mean, I heard you say earlier that you thought it was totally inappropriate for the paper to look at the students' publicly available social media profiles.
Well, I don't understand what publicly available means in this case. I mean, if they're going into her Facebook, because it's easy to do that through mutual links on campus, that's not necessarily public. I agree that she that they should have checked, because people joke around on Facebook. People could make up personas and say all kinds of things that aren't true. We teach our students never to trust anything they find online, and Wikipedia the same. It's not fact checking if you don't go to the source and say, you know, is this really true, or we want to use this material.
Well, I hear both of you saying this very important part of the due diligence that journalists must do in order to verify information that they're going to put out there in the media. But, you know, whether it's through information they've received through social media or at a public event. But I guess we just got a few minutes to go. And I wonder, you know, the third player in this big story are individuals themselves, you know, the potential sources for a story. Do people have, or should they have, basically an evolving expectation of what is public and what is private, since there is such a free flow of information that we can't necessarily keep up with? I mean, how is it that people are going to say more clearly, Kelly McBride, yes, I want this in the media, no, I don't?
Well, one thing is to use the settings on Facebook. But when the paper says it was publicly available, I'm assuming that her settings were set to public. And you can set your social media settings so that people who you haven't friended can't see your page, or they can't see your photos. There are a lot of settings on Facebook. And this is a big controversy with Facebook, right? Because Facebook tilts you toward the public settings. And it's up to you as the individual to dial them back. By the time you are a senior in high school, I generally expect that you should be savvy enough to know how those settings work. And I think that most people presume that making your information publicly available is a good thing, and then they lose control of their story and they realize that it's not a good thing.
Helen Benedict, we've just got a few seconds to go, but I wonder what your last thought is in terms of, these are student journalists. They're in college. We look to them as potentially being the next generation of the stewards of media. Your thoughts on what this story is telling us about how we educate and train young journalists?
They made one really basic mistake here. I don't think they should be closed down, but they need to rethink it, and this is it. You don't write a whole story about somebody without going to that person for comment. It's just a very odd thing to do. It's not proper reporting. Why didn't they go to her, get her comment, get her story directly, interview her?
Helen Benedict is a professor at the Columbia School of Journalism and author of Virgin or Vamp, How the Press Covers Sex Crimes. Helen Benedict, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Kelly McBride, senior faculty member at the Poynter Institute. Pleasure to speak with you, Kelly. Thank you so much for joining us as well.
You're welcome.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, let us know what you think, as always, about the story or any other you hear at radioboston.org. And stay with us, because up next, BSO conductor emeritus Bernard Haitink on leading two of the greatest works for orchestra and chorus. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty with Adam Ragusea. This is Radio Boston.